welcome, folks. Thank you for tuning in today. I'm Henrik. This is Red Ice Radio. I hope you're having a good start to your week. Well, today we have Matthias Wagner with us on the show. He's part of the Wolves, you know, the Wolves of Vinland. He's an artist into hexology. I will talk more about that later, by the way. But, you know, he has a lot of knowledge about the Norse sagas, the magic and the mythology, and he's just kind of an all-around really cool guy. He's into physical strength, fitness, tribal culture, the kind of stuff that's really missing from many men's lives these days in the confines and conformity of the modern world. So it's really good to have you here, Matthias. Thank you for coming on the show.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Tell us a bit about yourself first here. How did you get involved with the Wolves? Or I guess actually you started it with Paul, your brother. And tell us a bit about, I guess, the kind of the life that led you up to that point.
Well, I think, you know, at a certain point, Paul and I have always been very close growing up, and we've never really strayed too far from each other over the years. We've occasionally find ourselves, like today, living in different places, but usually we wind up remedying that some way or another, whether it's me heading to where he is or he heading to where I'm at. And so we also had two friends that we grew up with that we met when we were 6 or 7, maybe even earlier than that. Set of brothers as well. And so throughout all of our kind of social maturing and heading out into the world and having all the experiences that young kids should have, we always kind of had those people at our backs, you know, to help you out, to support you in bad times, to, you know, laugh and drink with in good times. And we were all kind of just always focused kind of on the extremes when we were young. We never really did anything half-assed, you know? And I think that those friendships and those brotherly bonds is what allowed you to kind of be able to jump into the abyss, knowing that, you know, there was going to be somebody helping you out or somebody pulling you out from above if, you know, the shit got too thick. And so that really raised a confidence level for us to kind of go forward and meet the world head on. And as we got older, you know, you kind of, at a certain point, as charismatic people, you kind of start to become popular in your own circles and kind of start building a persona for yourself. And obviously you're struggling as youth with the ego and how all of these things wind up fitting together that you have in your youth that you don't really have the wisdom to be able to apply yet. But you're hoping to compile an amount of experiences that will kind of create that wisdom in the end. And so we were living in Virginia at the time after kind of bouncing around from growing up in Wyoming and spending some time in California and winding up back out in Virginia, where we were actually born in DC. And so we wound up back there with this group of friends, the two brothers, and then a few other good friends of ours that had come from Wyoming when Paul had moved out there to meet me out there. And we kind of became popular in the music scene out there. You know, obviously Paul with his music is very good and has always been pursuing that. And we found ourselves kind of running a venue out of our house where we all lived, big kind of communal house. We were probably, you know, early 20s at this point. And we just realized that as we looked around how many self-serving people were there and people that, you know, would say had your back, but then obviously wouldn't, you know, backstabbers and, you know, people who were just kind of there that were along for the ride. And that was one of the moments where we kind of, you know, reinstituted how important our actual true friendships were to each other. And that we realized that these bonds and these friendships were actually what was drawing people to us. And that they were also being drawn to us, but then essentially just leeching off of you. And so I remember having a night where we kind of sat down and we said, you know, we're going to get rid of all these people. You know, they're worthless. They serve no purpose to us. And really, they're just depleting our resources to be able to live our own lives in the capacity that we want to live them in. And we kind of just reestablished that whole situation. And obviously, the Norse and Germanic paths have kind of always been near to us. Obviously, we started out, as many other people did, in magic and the left-hand path, and, you know, cool, wandering through Satanism, Crowley, you know, those sorts of things when we were young. But I remember when we were very young, probably maybe 12 or 13, we saw a book on runes, and I mean, we were just bloody by the end of the day from like cutting runes in ourselves. They were just such a powerful symbol that we just like immediately grasped onto. And, so at the time, there was a couple of people, we would discuss these sorts of things and discuss the myths, and as we were reading through them and kind of digesting them. And there are a few people out there that would come out to the house that said, you know, we know some people in the heathen scene, and I really think that they would be interested in meeting you guys and hearing your perspective. And that was really, for me, the first time I had ever really realized that there was groups of people out there that were, at least in some aspect or another, trying to, you know, revive the old ways. And so we started meeting with a couple of people in the local and kind of regional scene, and we realized that, like, how depleted of true, like, spirituality and philosophy and stuff that most of these people were, even though they had kind of found this angle and this route. They were still very Christian in their approach to it, or they were just taking all of these, you know, myths just completely literally, you know, thinking that there's a one-eyed guy in the sky and a guy riding a chariot around, and like the thunder is when he's clapping his hammer, you know, and it's like, that's kind of a step backwards,
yeah,
you know?
Right.
Of course. And, whereas, you know, we had been studied, we were brought up, in a pretty strict Christian household, but I mean, we were exposed to things like theology and dogma and, you know, all of these different types of enlightenment and stuff that kind of always fueled our approach to these things. And so when we read them, we were looking what appeared to be so much deeper into these things than the other people were. And then we also saw this aspect of community that comes along with all of this stuff, and how that is really the core, is creating the environment where these types of belief structures can thrive, and then where both the individual and community can thrive around them. And so that's kind of when we realized, hey, look, we already have a tight-knit community that can be an example to the people around us of how brotherhood should look, of how friendship should look, of how family structure, you know, should be upheld. And that the code that we had always kind of lived by, being somewhat unwritten, you know, was one that put honor first and put all of these things way higher above the individual. And so we just kind of started refining that. And that was kind of the, you know, the birth of the wolves, was refining it amongst ourselves, the people that we already knew who were in, and then kind of being very selective about how we were going to approach the people who were on the outside that seemed like they wanted to be in. So that's kind of how it got started, and how it really, really took off from there.
Cool. Well, I was actually reading up on your last name today, Wagoner. I read up on it. Some sources say it's from Saxony, others from Silesia. Both is in Germany, or at least in the territories that originally were, you know, Germanic. And these names actually come from Middle High German, meaning one who drives the wagon, right? A wagoneer. So you guys are actually you're going back to your Saxon roots, if you will, those relating to the Germanic or even Norse roots, and your structure in a way has been a lot about kind of trying to find an authenticity in the old way, so to speak, the pagan, the heathen, if you prefer that word. But it's right in line where you guys come from, so to speak.
Right. I think with a lot of the genealogical study that we've done, it heads back into essentially Wageningen, Holland, and a town that was actually founded by, I believe, a man named Gerolf Gerolfsson, who was of Norwegian descent, I believe. And so it kind of, our genealogy kind of trails off a little bit there. So we don't really know if we're of, you know, staunch German descent kind of, or Dutch descent, or if our lineage actually goes up through into the, to the Norwegian side. My little brother, Paul, got his, 23andMe, done, and it was heavily, heavily, Northern European. So we kind of assume that, that it's possible that we are descendants from the person who founded that town, possibly.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if the further back you go, the more of the same stock it was of people. Various different tribes and all that kind of stuff. But it's, you know, we're talking about the same people.
Right.
But, I mean, that's a really important aspect, I think, though, of just, you know, as you say, you might not find every detail. There might be some question marks. It is difficult, specifically with, people going to a different continent and then kind of tracking back in history and everything else. But it's about the effort of trying to reach back into your past and kind of finding out about it, reading about it, interesting yourself with it. And realizing that we have a past and a history, because usually that's actually denied to people of European descent, you know?
Yes, very much so. And I think that for us, it's kind of, searching into the past is as much about the future as it is the past.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a huge believer in, you know, ancestral memory and kind of that blood memory. And I mean, the more science that comes out about genes and DNA and all of this sort of thing really only continues to solidify, you know, the beliefs that these ancestral memories and stuff that have kind of been mythological words or just ideas. And it really starts to almost prove itself through science, you know? And I think that when certain things call to you, it's more than just a firing in your brain that makes you want to do something, you know, or a chemical reaction within your brain that makes you want to do this or find yourself in tune with that. And I really think that it is, you know, we view ourselves as the spearhead of our bloodline. You know, we are the tip of our bloodline that is a river of blood that has flowed through generations. And now we're responsible to, you know, make that tip sharp and make sure it hits the mark, you know, with every action that we have. And so as much as it's about, you know, rooting yourself in the past, it's also about using that knowledge and that information to be able to, you know, hone yourself and find your mark in the future. It's kind of like the, you know, wherever the shaft is, the end of the shaft of the spear will still point to where the head is sticking. And so you want to know, you can find the direction by either end of the spear.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's meant to be an inspiration. It's meant to give you also comfort. It does give you confidence. It gives you a realization that you also bear responsibility. As you say, if you're exactly at the tip of that, if you're at the front, it lies on you. But the point is that I have always felt when I was, you know, figuring these things out myself, I realized that I'm kind of not alone either. Within my components, the makeup of what I am are a string of people who in one way or another survived, if you know what I mean. They made it through, yeah, like hardship and starvation and wars and all these, right, kinds of things. And it gives you kind of a boost of confidence that is very important for us to have in these days, I feel, these times.
Yeah. And then, I mean, when you look at modern, the modern society, I mean, you have people who are just essentially genetic refuse that are still in a position where they can breed and their continued line of trash
yeah,
can continue to exist. Whereas, you know, even in America, I mean, even just a couple of hundred years ago, you know, all of these people would have died of, you know, all scarlet fever or, you know, you know, smallpox or something like that. Whereas now, you know, it's just a can that all of these people can continue to throw their genes into without even really understanding how important it is to, you know, foster offspring and the responsibility that you put on them. I feel a tremendous amount of responsibility to the people that have come before me to make sure that I put a mark, you know, not only on this time and in this place, but one that will be remembered and seen for a very long time. When you look at, you know, the sagas, you know, or throughout history in any aspect, you know, you have these names that you can just say that everybody knows. And I think that when people hear you say, I want to be a hero, I want to be remembered for 1,000 years, they say, oh, that's crazy, you know? Yeah. But look at how many there are out there that have done this, that have left their mark on the world so that thousands of years later, people still know their name. And that's what I want to be able to do for my name and my lineage, you know, leave a legacy that's more than just, oh, my grandpa died last year. You know, he was a good guy.
Yeah, I know.
You know, and that's pretty much what you hear, you know, even people in our generation who, you know, gather around the sacred fire to raise horns to the dead. Still, you find that, you know, there's not a great connection oftentimes to even a father figure, let alone somebody who spent a lot of time with their grandfather or their great grandfather, you know, and that it just kind of, you know, gets diluted through not having that contact and not having that emphasis on that bloodline, you know, for so many years in the distance that we live at. And it just kind of becomes very watered down. And you have these people who are even interested in that aspect of their life who still, they just don't know anything about their grandfather. And they want to tell me how he was a great person, but it's like, what did he do?
Right.
You know, he slaved away for 50, 60, 100 hours a week, you know, for 60 years of his life. And then he died. Like, yeah, that's, I guess there's a little bit of respect and honor in providing for your family and just being, you know, that guy. But I say it's a waste, you know?
Yeah. I mean, what kind of life is it? As you say, what kind of mark do they leave? I mean, we have family ties that are severed in many cases, and it's due to the fact that people they just don't fight anymore. They don't take on these big questions. I see this as a huge problem. I mean, in some cases, they don't even want to leave a mark. We even have a mentality in the world right now where, I mean, I kind of see it symbolically, but people talk about, you know, things such as like a carbon footprint, right? We're not meant to leave a footprint anymore. We're humans used to carve in stone that lasted for thousands of years. Now we have like spray cans that will be washed away. We're living lives, right, which is not meant to make an impact or leave a mark. It's like we came, right, and we just existed for a little bit of period of time, and then no one will remember us. I mean, that's awful. We live in the eternity of the memory of our own people, right?
Exactly. And, you know, like I said, it's my intention to, you know, have horns raised to me around sacred fires for generations to come. Now, will I be able to accomplish that? Not if I don't respond to that call of responsibility, not if I waste my life, you know, slaving away at the grind and come home and say, I don't have time or energy or the money, you know, to be able to do these things. It takes great sacrifice. No person that you've heard of that, their name is still around is somebody who didn't sacrifice all for something.
Yeah.
And I think that's really what men actually desire, is to find that thing that's worth sacrificing all for. And I think that in this day and age, we find men who have children and they say, I sacrificed all. And it's very true. You know, Josh Buckley wrote an amazing article for my brother talking about, you know, parents and how they say that they've sacrificed everything everything. It's like, well, you walk into your house and it looks like a McDonald's play place. You know, you spend all of your time, your excuse for why you're not in the gym, your excuse for why you're, you know, fat as hell, in bad health, why your wife is running the house, all of these things. It's because I have kids. And it's like, well, your kids aren't going to remember you, you know, because your life sucks. You forgot to build a legacy or to live a life that's worth living up to for those kids. And not to take away from a parent who, you know, struggles and strives to be able to provide for his children. But sure, providing for your children is not making sure they have their cell phone at 6 years old so that they can be on Facebook, is not making sure they have an internet connection so that they can play Xbox Live. You know, that's not providing for your child. That's actually brainwashing your child and making your child into the same shitty person that you are.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And it's, you are a slave to your child in all the wrong ways. And so I think, you know, these days everything that we're presented from modern society is linked to our basic instincts, but it is a perverted version of that. You know, we say you need food, water, and shelter. You know, well, your food is poison. Your shelter has to be 2,700 square feet or more. And your water you buy from the government.
Yeah.
And it, so it's like you're feeding your natural.
I know those two latter things are poisons too, by the way. It's just, you know, right, the water is like so fluoridated and poisoned. Anyway, go ahead.
Right. So you're feeding your natural desires, but they're all a ridiculous display of them. And so when you have a child and you're just giving them the life that modernity has told them that the child requires, you know, he needs to have his own room. I grew up in a room. I shared a room with all of my brothers. You know, we shared less than a room, you know, on many occasions. And that was, but we had food, we had water, and we had shelter, you know? And so now people are kind of, they have to go out and work an extra 5 hours overtime because they don't want their kid to be made fun of at school because they don't have the newest video game or they don't have, you know, man, newest phone or whatever. And that's just, it's ridiculous. And it's, they found what they have to sacrifice and they will sacrifice all for it, but there's no return. There's no return value in it. And so I think that that's the thing that we have to return to, is finding the thing that men and women, they're willing to sacrifice all. They're just doing it for all the wrong reasons.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good point. How would you say then, or I guess, what is your approach, your strategy in terms of, you know, let's take that question, creating a legacy. I mean, I guess it would be about focusing on the things that mattered the most in our time, and this will be different depending on where you are in the world and what kind of time we live in. Sure, everything is getting kind of globalized, so in many regards we're attaining the same problems, but my point is focusing on those kinds of battles that is most urgent at the time. That's where we can make our mark, that's where we can influence, that's when we can change things. I mean, in the old days, it was in the times of mythological epochs, they were fighting, you know, the dragons, basically. In other times, it was about winning over your enemy or you know, defending your territory or something like that. We still have these kinds of conflicts going on, of course, but it's about you know, picking the right battle, so to speak, and to a certain extent, right, fighting and defending. But what do you see? What's your approach or strategy to kind of create a legacy for yourself?
Well, I think you kind of nailed it in the sense that like you said, it has to be pertinent to your time. And when we started the Wolves, it was pertinent to our time and our little area in a small social structure in Lynchburg, Virginia. And then as we just continued to do and refine what we were already doing, it started to become more and more relevant outside of that circle. And people started seeing, okay, we're unsatisfied with our lives, but we don't know why. You know, we can't put our finger on it. And I think that we, just coming from a whole ideology that's backed by action, you know, I make a lot of mistakes in my life, but rarely are any of those mistakes because I did not act. I may have made the incorrect action at the time, but I acted. And you can at least learn from actions. And I don't live with regret either. And I don't apologize for, you know, what I've been done or anything in the past. All of those things have led me to be the person that I am today. And so they're all just footprints in the path to where I'm at. I think the problems with modernity have been, you know, kind of very well chronicled, especially in over the last couple of years with a lot of people's works. Obviously, I'm a huge fan of Paul's works and Jack Donovan's work. And I think that we find ourselves in a time where everything of value has been stripped from us and replaced by something else. And we see that these things are integral to our own happiness. And that starts, happiness starts in the spiritual realm. Spiritually edifying things bring about spiritually edifying actions, and that brings about that joy or that vunyo in an individual's life. And that's why these people who have worked for 60 years, you know, at their jobs do not feel spiritually enlightened or spiritually joyous, you know, after these events. And so I think that we have seen in our history the times where people's actions and their deeds were spiritually, physically, and emotionally edifying, you know? And so today we look at a society that is, you know, big government, everybody telling you what to do, what you can and can't believe, what you can and can't say, what's crazy and what's not crazy. And if you fall into any of these categories, you're kind of looked down upon and shunned because modern society has used essentially peer pressure and social peer pressure to control the masses at large. And now you're kind of at that point where, you know, people say, well, if you're, you know, if everybody hates you, you must be doing something right, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that we're kind of coming into our own on that, in the sense that community is a word that's used a lot. You hear it even paired with online community and you're like, what the fuck does that mean? they're literally, two different ends of a spectrum, you know, they're opposites. You can't have an online community. It's against the word and what it stands for, you know, but people have rushed into all of these different communities, whether it's your, you know, CrossFit community or your, like I said, your online heathen community, or even the heathen community at large in your area, you know, and it's just these bigger and bigger things because people think that community is better the bigger it is. Because I feel part of something bigger. But community cannot exist and cannot manifest itself correctly unless it has the resources within it to be able to do that. And that is something that starts small. And it starts with reliability. It starts with discipline. It starts with sacrifice. If you don't have people in your community willing to do these things for you and that you are not willing to do them for them, you don't have community. You have something that you're calling community, but it's not actual community. And then, you know, of course, we kind of go a step further and talk about tribalism as being a, you know, and I think you wind up using that word because community has been so retarded over the last, you know, couple of years that everybody's using it. You have to kind of find a new word to describe what you're talking about, because if you said community, nobody would know what you were talking about. Or they would think they knew what you were talking about, but they would be way off. And so, you know, we talk about tribalism and we talk about if you have set yourself up with a tribe worth being in, then that is what is worth sacrificing all for. You're sacrificing for your brothers and your sisters. You're sacrificing for the families around you. You're sacrificing your time. You're sacrificing your money. You're sacrificing your energy. Everything goes to that. And if it's the correct, you know, reciprocal circle, then all of that is coming back to you. And you're getting the time, energy, and resources of the other 50 people. And And now you're rich with all of those things. And all you have to do is give your all, and you get the all from everyone else. And so that's, I think, number one, a very important thing is that building your tribe, your community, and making it true is the first thing that people have to come to in order to start discovering what is actually worth sacrificing for. We think that socially in our modern time, this is one of the most important things. You can't be yourself out in the world, but you can be yourself in your tribe. I mean, I'm going to be myself wherever I'm at, actually, sure. regardless yeah. of what anybody has to say.
Of course.
But it's not going to be comfortable. It's not going to be a comfortable environment for you to be yourself. Whereas that's what your tribe should be. And that becomes a very joyful experience to be part of something like that, whether you're lending a helping hand or receiving one, and to know that this is something that you've paid into and now you're getting back from. But at the same time, you can't be a positive member of a tribe without being a amazing individual. So, you know, in our tribe, you have to put a lot of work in when you come and you express interest or we express interest in you. You know, you're going to get sat down and you're going to get your weaknesses pointed out to you. You're going to get the things that are not acceptable for our tribe pointed out, and you're going to have a period of time to fix those things. And so that's where you work on the individual. Then the individual can then positively affect the tribe. And this is important in modernity because you're not supposed to do that. This is one of the things that has been, you know, kind of shut down at every level, you know, especially for, you know, people of European descent. And anything that can be construed as a red flag, if you will, you know, is going to get a lot of backlash. And that backlash is what proves, you know, where you're at with it and how committed you are to it.
Yeah, exactly. Very good point. I mean, you mentioned that they managed to, you know, manipulate people and kind of impose inhibitions, you know, what to think, how to act, you know, political correctness, basically conformity, but they are not, you know, or are they not manipulating us on the basis of our tribal instincts? I mean, because today, in a way, we want to be, most people, they want to be liked, right? They want to fit in. They want to, in a sense, be part of a tribe. Today, right. it's like a global culture, of course. Now everyone is trying to fit into that. But and we kind of have a global community in a way, and the culture we're living has kind of turned into like a cult. But what my point is, what drives us to be part of a tribe, that's a healthy, good instinct. They've just managed to kind of fill this vital need with artificial groups and simulacrums. Exactly. They're just like, hey, divide yourself up in these, like, you know, here's a Furby group, as you say, or here's the gamer right. kids, or these small, tiny groups.
Yeah, you can find any peer group you want to be part of. And I think one of the positive things that we create and continually try to, you know, refine is a peer culture that is going to make you better. I mean, your peer group around you is what establishes what honor is, what respect is, you know, what courage is, what the best move is. And you can go find a group that says the opposite of everything that we say, you know. Heck, you can find a online community or a physical community of pedophiles out there that are telling each other that what they're doing is okay.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that is what the world has to offer is you're fat, you're ugly, you're stupid. That's okay.
You're number one. Don't so why try harder?
Don't
right?
get smarter. Yeah. Don't get smarter. You're okay the way you are. You're beautiful the way you are. Yep. You know,
horrendous.
It's and,
horrendous.
And they, right. And so they just foster all of these things that don't make anybody better, that don't strive to work on weaknesses. And so I think that's what makes our group increasingly relevant. And, you know, we get so much backlash for having an emphasis on physical health.
You're kidding.
And yeah. And I mean, it's insane. I mean, I remember 1 year, like everybody was like upset because, they thought we were racist. And then like the next year, nobody was even talking about that. They were just literally talking about how like we were fat shaming and like these were the worst things we were doing, you know?
Right.
And it's like physical health is like the number one thing that you can do, for yourself to make yourself a better person or to create a foundation to build that legacy off of.
Yeah.
You know, you can't build a legacy if you can't get off the couch, you know, and you got your leg chopped off because of the diabetes, you know, I mean, it just doesn't fit, you know? And so with the Wolves, what we try to create is a environment where you're going to be confronted and you're going to be possibly disciplined, but forced to work on yourself and to do that within the confines of the tribe. And that bringing in things from outside of the tribe, while there are many things outside that are positive that we can use as tools and footstools and stuff to continually climb to a higher level, your peer group is your tribe. And if you find yourself looking elsewhere, you know, for support, for, you know, somebody to pat you on the back because your peer group isn't doing it, then you're just going to find a new peer group so that you can continue to be the person that you are today. And you hear people say this all the time, I'm the same as I was 10 years ago and I'm the same today. And I'm like, that is depressing.
That's very
like,
sad.
Yeah. That means you haven't grown. You know, I always say you can change without growing, but you can't grow without changing.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a fact of life. And, you know, the human condition, I mean, I think just falls in line with that. You know, they want to be able to sit back. They want their luxury. They want their comfort. And those are all things that just pacify the human and keep them weak and keep them incapable of being able to act correctly, you know, during a relevant situation. And I think that we see that, you know, a lot today when you look at people online, you know, as you see like all of this Antifa stuff going on all over the world, you see a lot of people talking about it online and saying, oh, if this person did that to me, you know, he'd have something coming, you know, I'd shoot him. And it's like, cool. Well, you know, like even if you would do that, which you wouldn't, you know, cool. You're going to spend the rest of your life in prison because you were the only thing that you were capable of doing and able to defend yourself was pull a trigger because you're fat, you're out of shape, and you don't, you know, train for these types of things. So when that moment comes that you need physical prowess, that you need mental prowess, you know, a sharpness about yourself, you're not going to have it unless you've been training it.
Yeah.
And, so many people, they don't want to train it. They want to, you know, posture and say these things and act tough, but, their daily life is not surrounded by these things. And, so we just, you know, in order to build that legacy, in order to be capable of acting appropriately, that starts with having a physical body that is an appropriate vessel for the mind, you know, and the spirit. And you wouldn't put something special in a shitty box, you know?
Yeah, of course.
And if you put, even for these people who put the emphasis on, you know, being scholarly or being intelligent and all of this stuff, and they say, oh, I have so much wisdom to give the world, you can't discount me just because I'm, you know, hideously overweight. And it's like, well, what wisdom do you have if you can't even be wise enough to know that you should probably get off the couch, you know?
Right.
And okay. So you have a brilliant mind and it's trapped inside,
weak and feeble body. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You know, so what are you going to do with that?
It's amazing. You know, with the environment that we have today, what they're selling people, going back to the point you mentioned earlier, they are fostering not only sickness and maladjustment and disease, the very structure of it is dysgenic. And this is the program of modernity. And what really frightens me, frankly, about the situation, I mean, we can talk about this. In one regard, maybe it's good. Maybe this is a kind of a purging and method itself, that nature is once again kind of reaching back into the human world because we've been fighting it off for such a long time. Nonetheless, the message is that they're selling this to our kids. They're selling this to the next few generations. And this is possibly what's going to ensure our very destruction, right? I mean, think about it. What if something happens in the future? What if these systems that we rely on doesn't work anymore? What are these people going to do? I mean, literally, it's going to be mass starvations. There's going to be, and I don't even think it has to get to that point, to be frankly. Our dependency and inability to even just care for ourselves in the future is going to lead to, I think, catastrophe and just the dysgenic aspect alone. I mean, if we don't improve ourselves as humans, right? Where are we going to end up, right?
Right. And, you know, I think that there's always kind of a little bit of a back and forth between, you know, you see, especially for somebody like myself who wants to make my mark on the world, where I say, okay, like, here's where the battle is being waged. You know, that's, I need to be on the front lines of that war. But then I say to myself, I don't know. Like, I'm not really sure. Just because the battle is over there doesn't mean the battle is legitimate.
Yeah.
You know,
of course.
Doesn't mean I personally have a dog in that fight. And I think then the other side is, to me, when I look at the outside world, is the old, you know, that which is falling must be pushed.
Yes.
I revel in the fact if truly all of these people, if we are correct about what modernity is creating, then we should be happy. We should be absolutely enthused and sitting back and waiting for the fall, as Changes has such a great song about. And we should be there, you know, waiting for the fall, and but being prepared for it. And I think that's the biggest thing. When I look at the degeneracy around the world and just these things that I mean, I feel like an old person. I'm like, damn kids these days, you know, like, what is going on, you know? but at the same time, like, let them have it. Let them have their moment, because, you know, the cycle is always ongoing. And we just so happen, I believe, to be living in a more volatile part of that cycle. And, you know, volatility and violence and desperation are things that bring about great change.
Yeah.
And so I count myself lucky to be alive right now. You know, people always use the old adage, you know, you were born in the wrong century, or, you know, the wrong millennia. And I'm like, no, I was born in exact one that I was put here to live in.
Yep.
You know, this is my time. And as the wolves, this is our time. You know, we're a product of our environment, in the sense that wolves would not thrive unless there were so many sheep, you know? I think our message and our standpoints are only so relevant and out there because of the time. You know, if we were doing this 20 years ago, I don't think it would be as relevant as it is now.
Interesting. Yeah, because it's like a desire. It's a need to go back. It's almost like obviously it's a survival instinct, but it's almost like part of the, I see it as all these people that are recognizing this, they're starting to realize where this is going. Basically, just general pattern recognition will get you to a point where you realize that something is horribly wrong and this is going to go all wrong, right? And again, the fact is you have to have that pressure. I mean, again, many people have said that, but you don't create a diamond by, you know, not putting it under intense pressure. That's the only thing that's going to sharpen us and harden us. That's what it is. And we are asked in the modern world to back away from all those things that makes us uncomfortable, right? It's a constant just pleasure ride. It's supposed to feel good at every point, and you can't be offended. And I mean, this is going to create such weak individuals that, well, I mean, we're almost living in that world now, but where people needs to be defended from words because it hurts them. I mean, I don't even know what to say.
And, you know, I mean, I think, you know, one of the very great things about this is, you know, people ask me a lot, you know, how do you feel about, you know, the political climate, or how do you feel about, you know, the way your views are so, you know, looked down upon by the masses in the outside world and all this sort of thing. And it's like, look, that's what creates conviction. When I look and I say, I need to further remove myself into my tribe and away from this world, it's because I'm convicted that I am doing the right thing, because I step outside in the, you know, the regular world and I'm a target. You know, I'm a person that, I mean, when a wolf goes out into the world, you know, we got to have our heads on a swivel. You know, yeah. at any time, and usually at the most least expected time, is the time when that confrontation is going to happen. When you wind up, heck, you go to a show, you know, wearing a jacket, or, you know, if you're just, you know, some of the few of us that are, you know, recognizable characters, you know, they're going to recognize you. You're not going to recognize them. And that's what tells me that I'm living at least a controversial life, you know, you can go on Reddit or any of these things, and there's just calls for action against the wolves. You know, if you see these people, you know, fuck them up, you know, all of this kind of stuff. And it's like, you know, bring it on, because I don't care what you do. I am not going to stop believing what I believe and living the way that I want to believe. And if you want to come at me, you can, but you're only going to further convict me that I'm correct and that I'm against you. Yeah. And I love it when I see people come into the organization that maybe, you know, lived a slightly softer life and that maybe didn't grow up getting in fights at school and don't understand, you know, what it's like to have the shit kicked out of you, for any reason. You know, we try and put them through the ringer, you know, on their way through, to at least get a taste of that, so that they understand, you know, if you're standing next to your brother, you could be in some greasy situations pretty quick, you know, especially in today's climate. And, if you're not ready for that, then you're really not serving your brother very well, or yourself.
Well, you know, and that's really, it's really healthy. If you look at any animal in nature, you know, they, and I'm not trying to say that it's all play, but in a way, you look at cubs, right? They fight, you know, they fight pretty hard with each other too. They're obviously doing this for training purposes. They need to equip themselves to be in a situation where they can survive these types of situations. Exactly. I mean, the peace and the prosperity, and again, the, you know, me feeling good or whatever all the time, this is not serving anybody. It's not helping anybody. It's not something that would help your children, for example. It's actually harming them at the end. This is so weird, right? I mean, in Sweden, we live this incredibly isolated kind of existence in a way, where the state has like taken over the role of making sure that everyone lives in this certain way, but it's like ill-equipped, or people are ill-equipped to deal with conflict once that arrives, right? which is happening now. So we can see that it's a disservice, right?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the big thing here, when you look at, you know, the outside world and you say, okay, you know, we don't want to be that. That means you have to be something different. If you are not actively distancing yourself and creating an environment, to where you can, you know, further distance yourself from that environment, then you are belly up. You have given in. If you think that the best you can do in your life is have a $300,000 house and a $30,000 car, and that's what, when you come home, you're looking at your bills and you're thinking about your car payment and your house payment, and these things are your priority, you're belly up. You're part of the system. You're working for them. You're giving your money to them. You're continuing to support them. And you're one of their slaves. You may be a dejected slave who, you know, looks back at the master with a little bit of hate when the whip hits your back, but you're still a slave. And no thought can get you out of that role. Only action can. And I think that that's kind of the one of the things that we see as being so, making the movement so lethargic in a sense, because when people feel this way, then they go post it on Facebook. They don't actually do anything about it. They post it on Facebook, they try and get some likes, they maybe a conversation, and they theorize about everything. And as in my 12 years now in this kind of movement, I've seen so many people be simply hamstrung by theorizing their way around a situation and talking themselves out of any action, because they will sit there, the devil's advocate in the room will say, oh, well, we could do that, but then this will happen. You know, we could do that. And it's like, are you sure? Have you done it? You're speaking through theory. You're not speaking through experience. Go out and experience it. Go out and act, and then tell me what happens, you know? And so it's just one of these things where people think that just by wanting to be against something, that they are against something. And that's just simply not the case. You know, you have to find ways to stop giving all of your money to the government. You have to find ways to stop spending the majority of your energy and time in a normal work environment. You know, you have to find ways to curb these things, or you're simply a cog in the wheel, even if you're squeaky.
Yeah, that's true. Absolutely true. You know, in the second segment after break, we're going to talk a bit more about your artwork, and we can talk some more about some of the knowledge you have about the sagas and stuff like this. I'm looking forward to that. But as a way of rounding up the first segment here, Matthias, what is it, if there's anything else you can say about what it is that's important to you to fight, right? What you said the words earlier and you kind of took them out of my mouth. What is the front line of the battlefield today for you? And I know that it's not going to be the same for people, but let's assume that we had a situation where more people, more guys got involved in you know, being on the front lines of this battle. Where would you like to see that?
I think that it's not so different for everybody. I think that we're all after the same thing. I think we're all after freedom. And we've been told what freedom is. And then when we experience freedom as it's been given to us, it's not free at all. You know, everybody's a criminal. Everybody's one step away from going to jail. Everybody's, you know, about to get thrown in the gulag for one thing or another. And we see today that it's even more crossing into the ideas of, like you said earlier, thoughts and words. And when you can't speak freely and you can't think freely and you can't express yourself freely,
that is
where the screws start tightening down.
Yep.
And so the battlefield, I think, first right now is ideological. You have to be able to look at yourself and free yourself mentally first. We all have these things that hold us back, that tie us down, that we just can't get past to be able to embark on our greatest adventure of becoming free. And these things are the only strength in these cords holding us back are the power we give them with our own minds. And so today, you know, in a physical sense, I think that, you know, you're going to see small, what I would call skirmishes, you know, not necessarily battles, where, you know, you've seen them already, where people are getting attacked in the streets or, you know, confronted and, you know, or maybe, you know, like most of us have had all of our information, our addresses and everything given out to the public, you know, under calls for action to, you know, attack us physically or, you know, that they... as many of them work, you know, call your boss and get you, you know, fired from your job, or, you know, call a music venue and make them, you know, shut you down and cancel your show because of what is perceived to be as you know, belief structure that is not in line with the modern world. So I think this is where we're starting to see the warriors line up, you know, and choose a side. And I think that we all see people who we thought were on our side become apologetic. And Grimnir, Paul wrote a, or did a video on this where they lose the bass in their voice. Their posture becomes like they want to explain, you know, and they want to get out of that confrontation. And those people, if I'm standing next to a guy who's doing that, I'm going to kick him in the ass and push him to the other side, cause I don't want you on my side, you know? And, so I think that this is where the lines are being drawn, right now. But they're obviously much deeper root causes to these things, that, you know, for both sides, can be as ridiculous as to why you're standing in the line that you're standing in. But I think that we're seeing people start to get sick of it. You know, people are mad that they can't see the bands that they want to see because their show's been shut down. People are upset that, you know, right now, like, artistic expression is being so quelled today. You can't play this song or that song. You can't, you know, wear these symbols or those symbols. And so I think that the battlefields will be fought, you know, the battles will be fought over freedom, and they'll be fought over these ideas that you can't curb somebody's expression, especially spiritual expression, because your spiritual expression is exactly what's going to manifest itself in actions. And when you look at an organization like ours, who, like, we just want to head out into the woods and live our own lives, because this world has nothing for us, they won't even accept that.
Yeah,
they won't even give you your own little pocket.
No, that's just, and if they hate you so much, they should allow you to separate and do your own thing. But this is the thing, and I've been struggling to explain this to people too. It's like their interest lies in, or their interest is to make sure that you can't have any interests, right? And they need to dictate to you what you can think about, what you can talk about, what you can do. And it's like, that's one of the most dangerous aspects to this, I think, that they're just not... even people who disagree, let's say, with maybe the political stance or the ideology, they should be wise enough to see through that and see, like, okay, this at the end doesn't mean good for any of us. But they seem to be too stupid and just manipulated by, you know, the PC garbage on the media, right? So they turn against you. But anyway, go on.
And as kind of a metaphor, that's not so much of a metaphor, it's just on a smaller scale. A few years back, when I was still living in Lynchburg, we could all get, you know, really, really cheap housing in the lower income areas of Lynchburg. And so we have always, you know, lived in, some of the seedier parts of the town, you know, where, you know, in most situations, you know, we were maybe the only white people in the neighborhood, for blocks. And, you know, that doesn't bother me at all. You know, everybody has their own culture and their own areas. And, we realized, you know, we were in tune with that, and we realized that we're in their area, you know? And at one point, there was a disagreement with, some of the people from the neighborhood. And, I was maybe a couple of blocks down the street from my house. And, you know, they were upset with us. They were yelling at us, really posturing at us, you know, acting like they were going to, you know, make some physical moves and everything. And I was in their world, and I wasn't interested at all in fighting that battle in their world. You know, they can have it. It's theirs. But as we continued to back up and back up, we found ourselves in our yard, at the edge of our yard.
Yeah.
And I simply told them, I said, look, I have now backed up as far as I can go. I can't back up any further. So now you have to make the decision. You followed me this far, but now, as a man, I can no longer back up beyond this line. So if you're going to do something, now you're going to have to do it. And now I'm defending my world. I'm not simply just creating acts of violence in your world. I'm defending mine. And they decided that was the time to make their move. We were outnumbered almost probably by, you know, double the amount of people that we had. And we annihilated them right there. And it created maybe some more tense situations over the next couple of months. But, you know, at that point, it became a simple disagreement to a righteous cause. And so I think that that's where we're at right now. We're having simple disagreements with the outside world. And we're backing up. We're giving them their space because we don't want their space. We don't want anything they have. But when they come to encroach on what we have, now it becomes a righteous cause. And now it becomes something that has conviction and validity behind it. And so I think, I don't know exactly where that battlefield's going to be, because I don't know how far or when and how quickly they're going to press me. But as we continue to back away from their world, at a certain point, that line will have to be drawn to where we're defending ours. And at that point, you know, you're left with few options. And it's not that you've taken away your options. It's that they've taken away their own options and only given you one. And I don't think they want to find themselves in that situation.
Well, this is the thing. This is actually a very interesting point because, you know, I see this general attitude towards, you know, Europeans in our world today. They're backing us into a corner. And, you know, Sun Tzu said, the quote is, "To a surrounded enemy, you must leave a way of escape." Right? Because if you don't leave a way of escape, you're going to be fighting to the death with that enemy. And, and you know, that's not smart strategically to do that. And that's kind of the experience that you had, obviously. But that is a good metaphor, because I see that's happening on a bigger scale right now. And they don't seem to be backing down. And I'm not sure that they know what they're getting into. You know what I mean?
Right. And I don't think that a lot of us know what we're getting into. I think that there's some of us who have a general idea, and there's some of us who don't give a shit because we're going to be there regardless. And then there's some people that you've seen along the way that as soon as it gets a little serious, they break weak.
Right.
You know, and I think that the greatest thing that the opposition is doing for us is hardening the hard people and breaking the weak people. By the time any of this happens, our herd will have already been culled, and they will have done that for us.
Yes.
And that's, you know, great. And I probably won't have time to shake their hand for it, but, you know, I'm sure I'll make contact.
Yep. Exactly. Well, good point. Well, Matthias, tell us, you know, before we take a break here, where people can check out we haven't talked about your artwork, and that we'll get into that in the second segment, but you know, if there's any websites, both to you personally, but also the Wolves, obviously, if there's a way that people can kind of read more about your work and what you guys do, please plug those here at the end.
My brother Paul does a lot of YouTube stuff that's always very, very good. He also runs the Operation Werewolf page that is just under that name, that has a lot of great writings from a lot of different people, not just him. I have a personal Facebook page that I use for a lot of my contacts and stuff under my real name and everything. I'm not even an Odinson or anything like that. I am on Instagram. I'm at Werewolf Hexologist, which is where I used to, you know, put up a lot of my art and stuff like that. I mean, those are probably the first channels. Anything else probably will, you know, people will be able to find by following that. But yeah, YouTube, there's a lot of good stuff up on there. And then the writings, you know, that come up through the Operation Werewolf stuff, and then, you know, at Werewolf Hexologist.
Awesome. We'll have links up, ladies and gentlemen, so definitely check those out. And as I said, we're going to actually dive into that more in the second segment here with Paul and talk about the kind of artwork that he does, get into some of the, you know, mythology and some of the wisdom of the sagas. I know he's read up on this quite a bit, and he's very you know, knowledgeable in this, so he has a lot of good stuff that I kind of want to tap his brain on, if you will. So we'll get into that in a second. So everyone, do stay with us. If you want to sign up for a membership, it's redicemembers.com. This is how we make sure the show can continue. We are completely independent. We don't have ads or anything like that. So if you like what we do and want to make sure that we can continue, redicemembers.com. And of course, you get access to everything that we've done. We have tons of shows in the archive. So stay tuned, everybody. Stay tuned, Matthias. We'll be right back after the break.
There's talk of revolution, impending civil war. The lines are being drawn. the writing's on the wall. Ancient spirits slumber, the calm before the storm. Here awakes it, stretches, reaches for his sword. Waiting for the fall, my friend, just waiting for the fall. Waiting for the fall, my friend, I am waiting for the fall. The first shots have been fired, the battle has begun. The blood-red tide is rising, swelling like a flood. An age of soot and ashes, hero takes his stand. Let's have this out with fate, my brothers, liberate our land. Waiting for the fall, my friend, just waiting for the fall. Waiting for the fall, my friend, I am waiting for the fall. Waiting for the fall, my friend, I am waiting for the fall. Waiting for the fall, my friend, I am waiting for the fall.